Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why some advocates are optimistic about Glen Canyon's future.
And we'll meet the new director of the Mini Time Machine Museum of Miniatures.
But first, we have been watching the number of deportations ramp up under the Trump administration, but it's still unclear just how it will impact our economy or how it already has. Well, our first guest this morning is trying to figure that out in one key industry, childcare. Chris Herbst is an ASU Foundation professor in ASU School of Public Affairs, and he's the co-author of a new report looking at the impact of ICE activity on the childcare workforce. One out of every five childcare workers is an immigrant. And now, Herbst told me, they're not as protected as they once were.
On his first day in office, President Trump rescinded a Biden-era directive that provided protections for preschools, nursery schools, and childcare centers against ICE raids. So as a result, these programs were newly exposed to immigration enforcement.
Yeah. So you mentioned how many people who work in childcare in this country are foreign-born, are immigrants. Do we know how many are in particular Latino, which has been a large, you know, target for these mass deportation raids?
So it's certainly the case that that Latinos, in particular Mexicans, sort of comprise the largest group, the largest sort of foreign-born group of childcare workers, and that has been the case actually for a number of years. But having said that, it's a really diverse workforce, racially and ethnically, both among U.S.-born workers and foreign-born workers. Hmm. I would say something else that's really important when you compare the characteristics of foreign-born and U.S.-born childcare workers, it's actually the case that on average, foreign-born workers are more highly skilled. Hmm. They're more likely to have a college degree. They invest more in their own human capital or skills. They attend more classes to sort of enrich their skills. And as a result of this, it's actually the case that foreign-born workers earn more than their U.S.-born counterparts. So I would not think of foreign-born workers as an unlimited source of cheap labor. I mean, nobody's getting paid a lot in childcare, but foreign-born workers are not this sort of unskilled, low-paid segment of the childcare workforce. They're a really critical piece, not just because they exist in large numbers, but because they are relatively highly skilled.
That's really interesting. Okay, so let's talk about the findings here. You're looking at just since January, since the Trump administration took office and, you know, rescinded that directive you mentioned right off the top on the first day. And what did you find when it comes to how many fewer people who are immigrants now work in childcare just, you know, months later?
Right. I mean, we look at the first sort of 6 to 7 months of the Trump administration, we find that the increase in ICE activity, sort of we measure that by way of counting the number of ICE arrests that occur in local communities, that increase in ICE activity is associated with a reduction in the number of foreign-born childcare workers of about 39,000.
39,000. I mean, is that a drop in the bucket nationwide? Is that a big chunk?
Well, when you compare that reduction to the number of foreign-born workers that were working in the industry prior to Trump taking office, what we find is that sort of amounts to about 11% reduction in the foreign-born workforce. Not a trivial reduction, in my view.
Not at all. Do we know if those jobs have been replaced?
Interesting question. We also look at sort of changes among U.S.-born workers.
Right.
Remember that the Trump administration is sort of sold its mass deportation policy on the theory that doing these mass removals is going to sort of unclog the labor market, that it's going to create lots of new jobs for U.S.-born workers. We actually find that to be just the opposite. That theory has not been borne out. We find reductions in childcare employment among some groups of U.S.-born workers as well. So U.S.-born workers as a group are not better off. In some cases, they are worse off.
So overall, you're looking at a childcare industry, which we should say already, you know, was strapped for workers, with a whole lot less workers now than it had at the beginning of the year.
That's correct. the childcare industry really, I think, relative to many other industries, sort of struggled to reconstruct itself coming out of the pandemic. Wages are persistently low, and oftentimes childcare providers can't compete with the big box stores like Walmart and Target in terms of compensation. And that was one source of longstanding pressure on the childcare industry. What we're finding is that these deportations, this increase in immigration enforcement, is just another headwind for the industry to have to deal with.
Hmm. So there's another trend you identified and looked at in this study, which is sort of the flip side of this, right? Like at the same time, you were able to document a pretty big drop in working moms, right, of little kids who, you know, might benefit from childcare, to the tune of 77,000 fewer moms in the workforce of kids, like I think up to age six, right? I mean, that's a big chunk too. Obviously, a small percentage of, you know, the number of working moms with young kids around the country, but a big chunk. How do you kind of correlate those two things? Can you? Because I mean, there are lots of reasons why a mom of young children might leave the workforce, right?
Yeah, good question. I think it's worth pointing out that throughout 2025, the labor force participation rate of mothers has fallen by 3 percentage points. That may seem small, but it represents hundreds of thousands of mothers that are no longer employed. And we've been sort of having this discussion in policy circles and the media about why exactly we've seen this reduction. And some sort of theories about this reduction have been discussed around the rise in sort of tradwife culture, a more sort of conservative culture around work and family responsibilities. Perhaps it's the case that the return to office policies sort of pushed women, particularly mothers, out of the workforce. What we found was that not much had been discussed about the potential role of immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. Well, anytime there's a disruption in the childcare industry, that's going to sort of have spillovers to the labor market for mothers with young kids. And so we thought this analysis was an interesting secondary piece to conduct, to look at. And we did, in fact, find that the rise in immigration enforcement led to a pretty steep reduction in the number of mothers with young kids that are employed. And we think that that's really being driven by the disruptions in the childcare industry.
So just basically the premise is there that, like, it's because you think there are fewer places to send their kids, fewer workers to watch them while their mom's at work?
Yeah. I mean, if the childcare workforce is sort of contracted as much as we think it has, and by the way, there are some reasons to believe that our estimates are actually on the low end, that the loss of childcare employment is actually quite a bit bigger. Well, that just means that there are fewer childcare spaces available for families to send their kids.
Okay, so let me ask you lastly, Chris, just the big picture here economically, because this really is an economic issue at its heart, right? I mean, obviously it impacts families and workers on very personal levels. But if you have fewer moms in the workforce on one end, and then on the other end, do you have fewer immigrants in the workforce? I mean, what does that do for sort of the broader economic picture and for kind of family life in America?
I mean, I tend to think about this particular kind of increase in immigration enforcement as kind of a degrowth policy strategy. We've sort of certainly seen that in our data with the reductions in the childcare workforce and the reductions in the number of mothers employed. There will certainly be some negative implications for economic growth. And again, the administration's theory, its promise really, that these deportations will be a boon for U.S. workers has just not been borne out. And I'm just not sure that we as a society has kind of fully grappled with the potential downsides to this kind of immigration enforcement policy. Mm. If we're seeing these kinds of results in childcare, I would urge my economist colleagues, my researcher colleagues, to sort of start interrogating this question in other industries, perhaps for the labor market as a whole, because I think we do need evidence on the potential downsides of this kind of policy.
Okay. Chris Herbst, ASU Foundation Professor for the School of Public Affairs at Arizona State University, is the co-author of this study from New America. Chris, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So
Scientists, writers, artists, and others with an interest in the Colorado River got together recently in Moab, Utah for an event called Rivers of Change. It focused on Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell and what's happening there and how that impacts the rest of the river. Zanna Stutz is program manager at Glen Canyon Institute, a science-based advocacy organization which co-hosted the event. I spoke with her more about it, and we started with some of the main takeaways coming out of this.
I was so impressed by the positivity and the amount of care that just came out of this event. There was such a sense of, you know, this being a place that people care about and the ways that that care can then fuel action and movement and a vision for the future and what's going forward here. I think that there was a sense of, you know, all of these people that are coming together, whether you are a presenter with a art background or a science background, or you work for a nonprofit. And there were also people that contributed to this event in terms of science posters and art exhibits that were put up. And just everyone, you know, is fueled by the personal relationship that they have with the Colorado River and with Glen Canyon. But everyone was coming together to then share that, to inspire the work of other people and to build off the work of other people. And to engage in storytelling. One of the themes that really stood out to me was how, you know, humans are really hardwired for stories. And what we were doing, you know, at the Rivers of Change Symposium was gathering to tell stories, whether that was technical scientific information or indigenous storytelling or sharing inspiration for the stories that are embedded into artwork.
I'm so interested in the fact that positivity was one of the words you used to describe it, because it strikes me that that maybe is not something, you know, something that might be in somewhat short supply when you're talking about the Colorado River right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the really inspiring things about working in this specific niche for Glen Canyon, right? We are telling a story about a river that is coming back to life. And I think that the story of Glen Canyon for so long has been grounded in loss and anger and frustration for having drowned this place of immense beauty, not to mention cultural and environmental value. But, you know, when there's a perception that a place has been ruined forever, the side effect is like, okay, but what's, you know, what's the point of caring or doing anything about it? But as the reservoir has receded, and of course that is embedded into this larger trend of just hydrologically what's happening on the Colorado River and all of the political implications of that, what we are seeing on the ground is life returning to this landscape and, you know, kind of a transformation from a lens of scarcity to one of renewal. And I think that the hope that comes from what we're seeing in Glen Canyon is something that people are really craving right now. You know, as you said, a lot of the stories on the national scale of what is happening on the Colorado River right now is, you know, we're hearing about deadlines that are missed. We're hearing about a lack of transparency and public inclusion in the decision-making process. And that was a large part of why having this event be open and free and accessible to the public was so important to us.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned missed deadlines. I mean, your event happened just a couple of days after the federal government imposed deadlines for the Colorado River Basin states to come up with an agreement on how to divvy up the water. And of course, there's been a lot of arguing and potential litigation over this. And yet, it really sounds like what you're saying is there is optimism, there is hope, there is belief that better times are ahead.
Yeah. I mean, from the ecological perspective, what we're seeing in Glen Canyon is that as the reservoir is receding, this new landscape is emerging. And after a couple of years, it's native vegetation that is coming back. And, you know, you get a monsoon season and that water will scour the side canyon. And then you get, you know, you get free flowing streams that are coming back and you get cottonwoods and willows, and then the beavers come in and they are spreading the water table even further and allowing for the riparian habitat for birds. And there, you know, I think it's really amazing and really inspiring how quickly this landscape is evolving. And that was another theme that really stood out to me, was just the power of documentation, and that, you know, the things that we are seeing right now, it's almost like you are never going to be able to see that particular moment, that particular perspective again. But when we are able to document and then able to look back on this time, then you get a baseline of information for how to track what we are seeing over time.
So do you think that maybe we need to be thinking differently about what the Colorado River is and what the Glen Canyon Dam is and what Lake Powell is and maybe what they can and should be going forward? Is that sort of a change that we need to be thinking about?
Absolutely. I mean, Glen Canyon has ecological value and cultural value. It's not just, you know, this empty slick rock container for reservoir water. And I think emphasizing that experience of a living river and the vibrancy that comes from it, and, you know, the people who are all coming and convening and being inspired by this place, I think is really important.
When you talk about maybe the Colorado River or Glen Canyon Dam or Lake Powell maybe being a little bit different in the future, obviously so many people rely on the river for water. Is there a sense that maybe that cannot or should not continue going forward?
The interesting thing about Lake Powell in particular is that it is a reservoir. It is an upper basin reservoir, but with the exception of the town of Page, Arizona, upper basin users don't draw water directly from Lake Powell. And Glen Canyon Dam, as we have seen these low reservoir conditions, has really become a bottleneck in this whole system of water storage and delivery on the Colorado. You know, its lowest outlet as a way to pass water from the reservoir through the dam, still about 250 feet above the historic river bottom. And the lowest outlet tubes really were not made to operate in these low reservoir conditions. Every time those tubes have been used, cavitation damage has occurred to them. So, you know, I think that, you know, bringing up this kind of management and policy side of what is going on the Colorado River is really important. And also understanding, you know, that as these changes are occurring, we might need to take a larger step back and think about this larger system of water storage and delivery from this very pragmatic and logistical perspective, as well as this other emotional and more values-based understanding of, you know, what are the trade-offs to this particular piece of infrastructure, and how maybe has that changed over time as the hydrology has changed, as our energy landscape has changed, and as our understanding of its impact has become more robust.
All right. That is Zanna Stutz, Program Manager at Glen Canyon Institute. Zanna, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll hear from the director of a museum that features the work of artists who work in miniatures.
But first, every once in a while here on the show, we choose a recently published book and invite an avid reader from the community to come on and talk about it with us. For this installment, our co-host Sam Dingman and ASU grad Savannah Freeman talk about the novel Moderation by Elaine Castillo. Moderation explores the inner and outer lives of a content moderator named Girlie Del Mundo. Girlie works at a cutting-edge social media company that builds immersive online worlds. Think Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse, but even more lifelike. Girlie spends her days rooting out the most vile and upsetting behavior of users on the platform, and she's incredibly good at her job. Her ability to keep her emotions at bay as she deals with this sort of thing becomes a cornerstone of the plot. As she begins to develop intense feelings for William, one of the company's senior employees. Soon enough, Girlie and William find themselves locked in a tense standoff about where and when humans are truly safe to reveal their true selves. Moderation was named one of the best books of 2025 by The New Yorker, Slate, and Time magazine. Sam and Savannah began their conversation by discussing what Castillo was after in telling this story.
So I think, like, what she's really after is trying to create this story that kind of blends a lot of different like narratives and genres, and overall trying to tell the story of two people who are very sure of themselves and who they are and how that kind of changes throughout the book, and to really show like change in a person, especially like later on in their life, or like not a classic like young adult fiction novel, to really just like emphasize the amount of change that we go to at every stage of our life.
That is a very interesting answer, because I listened to an interview with Elaine where she was asked a sort of a similar question. One of the things that she said is she was sort of fed up with romantic comedy stories, which I guess implies that she's – I mean, this is a funny book in some moments, although comedy is sort of bleak. but she said, particularly with regard to Gurley's character, something that had always frustrated her was that a lot of times female characters in romantic stories had what seemed to her like sort of frivolous jobs. Like they worked at fashion magazines or they worked in PR. Not that those aren't serious jobs, but Gurley's job in this book is much more serious than that. She's watching these very traumatic videos that get posted on social media. So as a way of illustrating how Elaine gets at some of this, I believe you have a passage that you have selected.
The passage is, "When people asked where she was from, she said she lived in Vegas. In the end, she knew they'd never been meant to thrive. Not there, maybe not anywhere. They'd long ago been mutated. That was the capital F fact. Remade lifetimes and lifetimes ago to be forever tourists just passing through. Lifted by the dominion of centuries to live always just an inch off the ground, so no root ever stuck and no foundation went unshaken. Maybe it was because of this that she was more inured to such losses and indignities. Maybe it was because of this that she bore such daily disasters with self-preservating impassivity that made her, in the end, so good at her job."
Okay, so that bit at the end about the degree to which she is able to bear these horrific things – that for me gets at what I felt most struck by as something that Elaine was after in this book,
which
is I took it as a story about a survivor of specifically sexual trauma and the way that that experience makes some people able to, and in some cases even want to, sit with the most horrific things imaginable and not blink, whether that means going into like human rights work, what Gurley is doing in this story, which is content moderation for really extreme videos that get posted on social media, in her case, often depicting sexual content involving minors, which is stomach turning. As is alluded to in that passage that you just read, she has this ability to do that and not flinch or blink. It doesn't even seem, at least in the early parts of the book, that she's affected by it very much. Yeah. And then on top of that, Elaine writes these very unsparing descriptions of the videos that Gurley has to watch.
Yeah.
What did you make of those sequences?
I know when I first started reading it, I like had to take a second because it was so different from like the other books that I was reading, where I was like, okay, what am I getting myself into? But the more I really thought about it, and the more that you go through the story, you realize like how important it is, both in like the story itself, but also just in the conversation of how we handle and tackle like using the internet.
I'm really glad that you brought up the relationship to things on the internet piece of this, because I was reading this book in the days following the Charlie Kirk assassination. Yeah. And one of the things I was thinking about as we are introduced to Gurley's world in the way that we were just talking about is the speed with which the extremely graphic video of the moment that he was shot just popped up in people's social media feeds without warning.
Yeah.
And there was almost no way to choose not to watch it if you are even a little bit online.
No, definitely.
It was just presented to you, and now that's something that you have seen.
Yeah. No, and I think like especially just with the landscape of social media and the dual ability to both inform people, which I think is like one of the greatest treasures that we've had like through the internet, is like the connection of people, especially in different countries and different situations. Is with that, you also get like the truth behind it, which is a lot of graphic imagery.
So far, we've been talking about some of the very heady elements of the book. But as you were alluding to at the beginning,
There is also this really rich, interesting love story that's happening. This makes me think of one of my favorite passages that I would love to get your response to, because in addition to that desire that they so clearly have for each other, something I appreciated in this book that I think is rare to see is the way that she wrote about William's love for his best male friend, who is one of the co-founders of the company that they both work at and who died by suicide. Mm-hmm. And William very clearly loved this person, not in a romantic way, just in a friend way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think is really nice about the way their relationship develops is before anything happens between the two of them, Gurley helps William make friends with that idea that he loved this other character. There's this one moment where they're sitting and talking to each other, and Gurley asks William if he loved this character who was his best friend. Mm-hmm. And William says, I'm quoting now from the book, "He was my best friend. He cleared his throat. So, yes, I suppose I loved him." "That's nice," she said. William blinked. "Loving someone, having a best friend," she clarified. "It's not nothing. It's not nothing," he agreed. I love that moment so much because you can see that it is so difficult for him to let himself call this feeling love.
Yeah, definitely. No, and I think with that as well, like, we talk about, like, the idea of haunting a narrative. I think throughout, you really do get to have these pockets where you're able to see the things that William went through and how that makes that moment so important, where they're having a time together and they're really trying to, I guess, like, break through those layers, even if it's unintentionally, and having a nice moment together where you're able to see sort of the shift in both the characters, where he's able to, like, have that comfort in knowing that despite everything that happened, that he does have love for him.
Let's talk for just a moment about some things that maybe didn't work as well in terms of what Elaine was after. What for you didn't quite get there?
I think there definitely could have been a little bit more even spacing towards the end of each of these moments, because you kind of lose that element of intimacy with these descriptive scenes and settings that are happening. So I kind of just wish there was a little bit more. I wish she would have, like, really dove into more of the end plot.
I agree with you completely. And I'm glad you brought this up, because I had this feeling towards the climax of the book. It is revealed, in my opinion, very suddenly that there was a lot of shady stuff going on at this tech company that they both work at. And a bunch of people get busted for embezzlement and other things that they were doing. And all of that is revealed in the course of a pretty small number of pages, basically in, like, a really long monologue that reminded me of one of those murder mysteries where the detective walks in at the end and goes, "Here's how I figured it out."
Yeah.
And they just kind of lay it all out. And it's like, I didn't really see a lot of seeds about this planted.
Yeah.
And it's very complicated and feels a little bit convenient. And it was in such contrast to the things that, to your point, work so well. There's this very long scene where it's just Gurley and William sitting at a table eating French fries together. That's one of my favorite scenes I've ever read in a book. You know, they're just little by little. That's where the "I loved him" scene happens, if memory serves. And it's just these little teeny details about each other that are getting revealed, like, with each bite of French fry. And there's so few words, but so much meaning. That could have been the whole book, as far as I'm concerned.
Seriously. I think that says a lot to, like, just the specificity that you see throughout the whole novel, and how, in relation to Gurley looking at William and initially having all of these sort of judgments, and really you get to see, like, through the eyes of Gurley, all these different sort of, like, preconceived notions that she's putting on other people as kind of a defense mechanism for herself, and how she's able to sort of, like, piece herself into the world around her. And I think using that level of detail throughout really just allows the reader to fully understand not only the area that she's in, like, where she is emotionally, where she is in her career, but how she wants to fit her narrative, and how that then goes into her love story with William, and how she's able to sort of, like, break those molds and have those really intimate moments with, like, something as simple as sharing fries together.
Well, the book we've been talking about is Moderation by Elaine Castillo. And I have been speaking with Savannah Freeman, recent graduate from ASU's School of Sustainability and avid reader. Savannah, thank you for reading the book and thanks for talking about it with me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Ousted Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and his wife, as we heard, are in New York City, where they're expected to make their first court appearance today. This, of course, follows U.S. military action in the South American country on Saturday and has led to a lot of response from around the world. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Audrey Tinlin. And Audrey, how are governments outside of the immediate region reacting to all of this?
Yeah, there's been lots of reaction worldwide. Russia and China have both condemned the U.S. bombing of Caracas and that extraction of Maduro and his wife. And China's been very vocal over the past couple of days. And this morning, China's foreign ministry spokesperson said again that it was critical of the U.S. actions. It's called for the immediate release of Maduro and his wife. And the Chinese state-sponsored media has been giving this story plenty of airtime. It's very prominent there, our colleagues who are watching the China news tell us. To note just one outlet, the official Xinhua news agency has been saying that the US raid on Venezuela sets what it says is an extremely dangerous precedent. Here in Europe, the EU has been quite restrained by comparison. It's calling for respect for international law and respect for the will of the Venezuelan people. But some individual countries have been more outspoken, notably France and, of course, Spain. Now, Spain's home to the largest Venezuelan migrant population outside Latin America and, of course, the US. And there's been reaction from Venezuelans on both sides of the political divide. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has already said that his country will not recognize a U.S. intervention in Venezuela that violates international law. And that's the important bit which is now being argued about. And Spain, of course, has recently been home to senior Venezuelan opposition figures. And these include Edmundo González. And that's the man who is largely judged to have won Venezuela's 2024 presidential election. So it will be very interesting to keep an eye on what's happening amongst those Venezuelan political exiles in Spain over the next few days.
Yeah, that will be important to keep an eye on. Audrey, let's go to Ukraine now and efforts to find a lasting peace and put an end to Russia's war there. There's a meeting of the so-called Coalition of the Willing Nations in Paris tomorrow. What can we expect from that?
So this Coalition of the Willing, which of course has been in operation for quite a few months now, is mainly European, and they will gather in Paris to discuss these next steps in their support for Ukraine. They'll also be joined tomorrow by Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney, who's going to be at this particular meeting. And this all comes against the background of the US efforts to broker a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. And the coalition says that the meeting tomorrow is likely to cover security guarantees for Ukraine after any end to the fighting, as well as economic agreements and sequencing plans for next steps if there is an agreement to end the war. Ukraine has asked the US and European leaders for those security guarantees, and it wants to ensure a NATO-style response in the event of a future Russian attack, though Russia's made it clear, of course, that it won't accept any European troops on the ground in Ukraine. Today, President Zelensky has announced the appointment of Canada's former Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, as his economic development advisor. So Ms. Freeland has Ukrainian ancestry and she speaks the language fluently. And Mr. Zelensky has praised her skills and experience this morning in attracting investment, in implementing economic transformations. And he says Ukraine needs these skills to strengthen its recovery if peace talks go well and to reinforce its defense if the talks are delayed or fail.
Audrey, let's go now to Iran, where demonstrations on the streets there have entered a second week. Has the government made any concessions to those protesters?
Well, the government is taking a dual approach here. On the one hand, it is saying that it will have talks with what it calls the legitimate protesters, but it it will clamp down severely on anybody who is instigating violence. Now, we don't know exactly what that means on the ground because it's very difficult to get reliable figures out of Iran. But rights groups are saying that at least 16 people have been killed so far. And those figures seem to be more or less correct as far as we can tell here at the BBC. And the protests are over soaring inflation, which has spread across the country. And that started off these protests between shopkeepers, and then students joined in. And the whole thing seemed to have steamrolled on from there. Now, Iran's faced inflation above 36% since the start of its year back in March. And its currency has also been falling, and it's lost about half its value against the dollar, for example. So in this dual approach, the authorities say that they're now going to give a monthly payment to most Iranian citizens. That will only amount to about $7, but that's money that is sorely needed by many people in Iran. But they've also said they're going to continue to clamp down on anybody who does not listen and clear the streets of those protests, though as far as we can tell, the protests are still ongoing.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Audrey Tinlin in London. Audrey, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The Mini Time Machine Museum of Miniatures is a fixture in the Tucson art scene, and it does a lot more than showcase tiny versions of things. No, Tucson's Miniature Museum is a true art museum. One of its latest exhibitions showcases signage of the old Pueblo by artist Jorge Ruiz. Another highlights the cultural history of Japan through tiny carved sculptures. And it uses miniatures to help us all think about scale, from exploring the art of model railroads to the scale models used by filmmaker Ray Harryhausen to create Clash of the Titans and the Argonauts. And its new director is interested in exploring just how far she can take the art of miniatures. Meg Hagyard took over the role after spending a career in Tucson arts institutions, from the Tucson Children's Museum to the Tucson Museum of Contemporary Art to the University of Arizona's Art Museum. She came into our studios recently and told me she's always been an arts person, from when she was a kid to getting a degree in studio arts in college to working in arts nonprofits to museum work. But the Museum of Miniatures is nothing like she's ever tackled before.
The museum was founded by Pat and Walter Arnell, and Pat Arnell began collecting miniatures, dollhouses, and they moved to Tucson in the 1970s. And from that point, Pat was traveling around the world collecting miniatures, and she was a miniaturist herself, so she would build dollhouses. She would collect other people's work and really built this incredible collection of over 300 dollhouses and other kinds of miniatures. But for us, when we say the Mini Time Machine Museum of Miniatures, we're talking about things that are playing with scale. So it's things that are smaller than they would be in real life, often done in a hyper-realistic way, but not necessarily always. So that's the fun of this kind of medium, is that you can really bring in fantasy elements. You create your own realities. It's a way of storytelling.
Did you say a miniaturist?
Yes.
That's the phrase. That's so cool. So yeah. Like artists who work in miniature,
yeah,
basically?
Absolutely. Huh. Yes. And this is a long established craft in Tucson. There's the Tucson Miniature Society, which is a 50-year-old organization.
Wow.
A lot of people, when they think of miniatures and they think of museums, they will think of the Thorn Rooms. For example, the Phoenix Art Museum has 20 Thorn Room boxes. So we have some of that very formal, classical spaces. But then we also have a whole room that's dedicated to fantasy realm. So it's Christmas all the time in parts of the museum, which is really wonderful and charming. We have artists who are really dedicated to accuracy in historical depiction of what they're working on, and then others that they are just pulling from all types of different things and creating their own worlds.
Yeah, imaginary worlds in this beautiful way. The motto is preserving and advancing the art of miniatures for all. So this is not crafts. This is art in a real way. And you
absolutely
bring in shows and do kind of work with artists that have kind of the same kind of commentary that any artist would have any other institutions.
Yeah. And then one of the things that we do is also showing people how miniatures are used in different fields that they might not have thought of. So, for example, right now we have an exhibition by Ray Harryhausen, who is sort of the, you know, the grandfather of stop motion animation, known for films like Jason and the Argonauts and Clash of the Titans. So he worked in scale in different ways. Not everything that he did was maybe specifically miniature, but his relationship to working with scale absolutely fits in what we do. And so when you come in the museum right now, you get to see all of these incredible creatures that he made for films. Yeah. And then, of course, miniatures have been historically used in architecture, you know, prior to all of the incredible technology that we have available now. People were making scale models. And so there's lots of different industries. The automotive industry works in scale models. Huh. So it's a fun way for people to both connect and understand just how to think about scale, how it's applied in the world, not just by artists, but in many different ways.
Okay, so you talked about sort of what's in the museum and what these miniatures are, the mission of the founders of this museum. How do you want to take this into the future?
Yeah, we are very committed to working with contemporary miniaturists. So I think that's one of the things that we are very excited about, is following where miniaturism is today and how it evolves. So it's not going to look the same as it did in the 1980s as it's going to look in 2030. So the museum is able to really follow the trajectory of the field.
What do you think is going to change in this field in the future?
Well, Instagram and social media has been tremendous for I think the awareness and interest in miniatures.
People taking pictures of little scenes they create.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole, you know, there's a whole thread on miniature food, and whether it's models of food or people actually making miniature food that's consumable. I think nail art is really fascinating. There is a lot of playing with scale and even three-dimensional representations in nail art. So I think that's what's exciting, is that we can't predict where miniatures and the idea of playing with scale is going to show up for people.
Sure.
But there is a heightened awareness and interest in it right now, which is very exciting for us.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's an interesting moment for
it.
Let me talk to you about your philosophy on museums, right? Like, since you've worked in so many different types of museums throughout your career, and now you're taking the helm here, this is an interesting moment, I think, in museums, because we've seen them really change in terms of how the space is used. Like, they're not as quiet or, you know, serious maybe as they once were.
Right.
There's lots of interactivity that's very cool in museums right now. How do you think about this in terms of the Museum of Miniatures?
Yeah. So one of the things that's wonderful about the Museum of Miniatures is that it is an unexpected experience for people typically. And like you mentioned, people and libraries have certainly changed a lot too. But libraries, museums, you were supposed to go and be quiet and behave a certain way and not necessarily the place that you wanted to take your children because you needed to manage them. So the Museum of Miniatures is kind of an in-between space where you get to explore, there's curiosity, but at the same time, we're also committed to the educational side of the mission of the museum. So you can come in and have one kind of experience one time and focus on, you know, being charmed by the contents of what you're seeing and amazed by thinking about how did somebody craft these, you know, tiny little silver spoons or these, you know, crystal goblets. And then the next time you come in, you could really investigate an artist's perspective and that, you know, commentary they may be making through their work. So there's lots of different ways to come at the material, which I think is wonderful.
Yeah. So last question for you then, because you mentioned it. How do artists create a tiny goblet or a tiny silver spoon?
Well, I mean, in very different ways, depending on the artist. So some artists, like a dollhouse specifically, you take a dollhouse, you look at it, and you may see wallpaper, you may see a wooden floor, you may see a velvet couch. And in some cases, that wooden floor, the artist has hewn individual pieces of wood and laid the planks. And it's literally a reproduction of the process of putting in a wood floor like you would in any kind of space.
Yeah.
And then 3D printing is also making a change in miniature. Some people are very committed that every single aspect of it is handmade by them. Other people are utilizing technology like scanning objects. We have a collection that's going to be coming on view of furniture that's actually in the Getty Museum, their collection. And this artist has remade these objects in miniature, some of them handmade, some of them using 3D technology. So, yeah, any kind of tool that you can think of that artists are using, miniaturists are using as well. Mm-hmm. We have Baccarat crystal that is Baccarat crystal, but in miniature. So how the artist was able to carve the crystal, I can't tell you how it's done.
Maybe it's better if we don't know.
Yeah.
The mystery remains.
Yeah.
My goodness. All right. We'll leave it there. That is Meg Hagyard joining us, executive director at the Mini Time Machine Museum of Miniatures, joining us from Tucson. Meg, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And that's it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Reminder, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at KJZZ, the show.